We'd like to take a moment now to talk about an issue we've visited a few times on this program, diversity in the media. Diane Sawyer recently announced that she's stepping down as anchor of ABC World News.
You may have heard some exciting news from right here at home at ABC. At the end of the summer, I'm going to be moving to a new role at the network, full-time, flat out, of reporting I love from around the world and in-depth specials on the stories that matter so much to all our lives.
The change at ABC means that David Muir, who currently hosts ABC World News Weekend, will step in as anchor during the week, and Good Morning America co-host George Stephanopoulos will take on a new role as the face of the network, for example, steering election night coverage. And while these kinds of changes happen periodically in a business that places a lot of physical and personal demands on people, it's also reviving the debate about the importance of diversity in television, especially television news, because after Sawyer's departure, all the broadcast network nightly news programs will be led, once again, by white males. So we're going to talk about this with Eric Dagans. He's NPR's television critic, and he's with us now in our studios in Washington, D.C. Eric, it's nice to have you back with us.
Great to be here.
So before we talk about the news programs, I want to talk about something else that has recently happened. Some recent developments on ABC's daytime program, The View. Longtime host Sherry Shepherd announced that she will leave the program after serving as a co-host for 7 years. And then after that, another host, Jenny McCarthy, the actress, announced that she'll be leaving. And she even tweeted about it, saying, if Sherry goes, then I go too. And I just wanted to ask, what do you think this all means?
Well, it's interesting to see that all of these changes, including the rumored departure of Bill Getty, the longtime executive producer of the show, right after Barbara Walters leaves. I think if you read the tea leaves, as long as I have in television, once Barbara was gone, it seems as if ABC is making the kind of changes they wanted to make. And I think there was a sense that they wanted to blow up the panel, make it more interesting. Jenny McCarthy's always had a hard time fitting in there. And now that Barbara's gone, perhaps ABC has a freer hand to remake the show the way they want to.
Back to the Diane Sawyer announcement. The question that I have to ask is, what does it mean that there were, a couple of years ago, both Katie Couric and Diane Sawyer were anchoring evening news programs, and now it's back to where it was,
where it was before.
Yeah.
I think a couple of things are going on. Number one, we have seen the importance of the evening news diminished. The sense that they have taken all the big marquee things that the evening news anchor used to do, like leading election coverage and breaking news coverage, and given them to George Stephanopoulos, who's the morning anchor, I think that's significant. David Muir will have a lesser role than somebody like Peter Jennings, because it will be much harder for him to be the face of the network. Also, though, what we've seen is this lack of a pipeline for female journalists. Who could come in and anchor a network evening newscast at ABC? What woman is positioned to contest with David Muir for that job? Where's the pipeline for female talent? Where's the pipeline for people of color in the network news game? And let's create one if there isn't.
Well, why is that, though?
I think it's a specific choice. For example, I just came out of newspapers. In the newspaper where I used to work, the Tampa Bay Times, women are in key leadership roles throughout the organization now. It's something that's happened over the last 20 years. Are we seeing this kind of pipeline built in the network news game? Who's the executive producers of these shows? Are women being able to ascend to those jobs? And when you have people in a job who can picture a woman anchoring, then maybe they'll allow them to anchor. I just can't believe that in 2014, there's not enough female talent out there to fill the ranks of these network news anchoring jobs. And the fact that there isn't tells me that there's something else going on beyond the numbers game or chance, or they just can't find the right people. They're not trying to find the right people.
But you also said that George Stephanopoulos being named chief anchor, and he is the anchor of the morning show as well as the Sunday morning public affairs program.
Sure.
What does that suggest? That they consider really morning to be driving?
Morning is the most important day part for network news because it makes the most money.
Generally, but the numbers aren't the biggest, though. That still has to be said. The network evening news programs still have bigger numbers.
They have bigger total audiences, but when you look at the core demographic that they charge advertising for example, Good Morning America draws a little more people aged 25 to 54. than the evening news does. So aggregate audiences, evening news does better. But in terms of the money-making potential, and it's not just that it's demographically they have more numbers, advertisers want to be in that show more. You know, they feel like they're reaching their ideal consumer. They're reaching women who are making the purchasing decisions for their households often. And so I think it's not just that it's more of that demographic, it's a more desirable type of that demographic as well.
But what's the diversity picture there? I mean, women are famous for being morning news anchors and having a big impact as morning news anchors.
Exactly. And so that's the one bright spot, is that if the power position in network news shifts to the morning, then the women have a better chance of getting in on that action, because there are women in the morning shows who are more than qualified to be the face of a network news division if they're developed. Savannah Guthrie on NBC's Today Show has a hard news background. Certainly, if she wanted that job, she could contend for it. So that's the one bright spot, is that by shifting the center of power to the morning, at least women will have a shot to play in that game a little more than maybe they do now.
We're talking about diversity in television with NPR's television critic Eric Dagan. So let's talk a little bit about Elsewhere on the Dial, not a news program, but one that's generating a lot of interest and some fairly heated response. It's a program called Tyrant, which premiered last week on the cable network FX. It's a show about a California doctor who is the son of a dictator of a fictional Middle Eastern country. And I have a short clip from the first episode where the son, Bassam, sees his father for the first time in about 20 years. And in this clip, the father, the dictator, talks about protests in the country.
After everything I've given the people, you're still not satisfied. They say they want freedom. Freedom. To do what? Kill each other?
This is a show that's getting a lot of attention because a number of advocacy groups that represent people of Muslim or Middle Eastern background say they are outraged about this. They think it's racist. I do want to mention that there is one group, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, that says that they were involved with the production. But Eric, what about it?
There's a sense when you watch the show that the more Americanized characters are considered the more virtuous characters. And the problem is that many of the characters who are Arab or Muslim on the show are bloodthirsty. The first time you encounter an Arab character, you see the brother of the lead character, you know, raping a woman. I think they really have a point. It could have been so great. It could have been a very nuanced depiction of what do you do when you have a tyrant who's bloodthirsty, but maybe he's holding together a country where everybody else is bloodthirsty too, and everybody's got, you know, blood on their hands, and how do you deal with this? But instead, you have this Americanized son who left the country, and then he comes back and he has all these ideas about free speech and a new way of doing things, and he's presented as the virtuous guy who will stop his bloodthirsty relatives from pillaging the country that they've run for 20 years. And I would not blame an advocacy group for looking at that and saying that's just not a fair depiction of Arab life or of Muslim life.
Is there any response from FX about this?
They did set up a screening for some representatives of these advocacy groups, and I interviewed a representative of one of them who said he walked out of the screening when he saw the second rape scene involving this brother in the pilot. I mean, you know, the guy assaults a woman not once, but twice. There's also a scene where that same character cuts off someone's finger. So I think the only hope is that as they move forward, or even if somebody else decides to do something like this, the idea is promising, but you have to be careful to not create these stereotypes. And unfortunately, they have created a show that is just filled with them instead of taking the opportunity to subvert them. And when you subvert stereotypes on a TV show, that's when it's interesting, because you don't know what to expect. You can't look at a character and predict how they're going to act. And that's why I don't understand why more TV shows don't do that anyway.
Eric Dagans is NPR's television critic. He was kind enough to join us in our studios in Washington, D.C. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Next up in tech, something infinitely lighter.
That's right. A very brief two eyes at the Earth globe of smiley faces.
Melissa, please translate into English.
Okay. Robert, that's emoji speak for a very brief look at the world of emoji. And for those unfamiliar with emoji, they are those cartoon-like images used on smartphones and the internet in place of text.
A heart, a winking eye, a cheeseburger. The most familiar ones are yellow smiley faces, all variations.
A winking smile, for instance. Emoji are standardized just like every other language on your phone, and this month the Unicode Consortium approved some 250 new emoji. Unicode is an international nonprofit that sets the industry standard for computer text, and here are some of the new characters. Try using these in a sentence, Robert.
A hot pepper, a chipmunk, a camera with a flash.
A passenger ship, an oil drum, a golfer.
Fork and knife with plate, derelict house building.
And man in business suit levitating.
As one does so often in a business suit. Now, there's also an overt insult included in the new characters. That's something new. It's called reversed hand with middle finger extended.
Uh-huh. But where did emoji come from? For that, we'd need to trade in our smartphones for pagers and head back to the 1990s. A Japanese telecom company called Docomo was the first to use emoji. The ability to send an image of a cartoon heart was one of the special features on Docomo pagers.
And Japanese teenagers hearted it. Shigetaka Kurita, who was working at Docomo, is credited with creating the first emoji in the late 90s. We asked him about his inspiration, and he told us, I designed them myself, he says, based on pictograms commonly seen around the city or from Japanese cartoons.
One early user of emoji was Takehiro Ariga. He's now editor of the Japanese trend magazine Nikkei Trendy. He says people loved it because it resolved miscommunication.
Japanese hate direct communication. So saying my emotion by using emoji or picture is better way to express myself in more gentle, softer way.
Well, fast forward now more than a decade, and emoji are on nearly every phone. Apple added an emoji keyboard to its operating system for the phone in 2011, and the rest, as they say, is...
symbol for an open book?
I was just going to say history.
Independence Day comes this week, and so does the second season of Drunk History.
Today we're going to talk about Francis Scott Key, the man who wrote the American National Anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner.
That pretty much tells you what Drunk History is, a Comedy Central program in which people recount and reenact genuine history after a drink or two, or three, or four. It started as a web series on funnyordie.com and is now in its second season as a TV show. The show's creator spoke with our Steve Inske.
He's Derek Waters of Baltimore, Maryland. He's on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me.
So why do history this way?
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but overall, history is pretty boring. But history is very important. I grew up with the best history teacher, Mr. Stang, who's still teaching history. And the reason why I liked history was it was how he taught it. And I believe if you can make someone laugh, you can secretly make them learn something.
And I suppose the storyteller is always, shall we say, enthused about the tale that they're recounting.
They love it. And they need to get it out.
Under the control of Vice Admiral Alexander Cochrane.
No matter how many stumbles it takes.
Now, we heard a clip from the upcoming season. There is an episode centering on your hometown of Baltimore. And, of course, there's the story of Francis Scott Key and the Star-Spangled Banner. Francis Scott Key, as many people will know, went out during the War of 1812 to secure the release of a prisoner. He was held on a British ship as they were bombarding Fort McHenry in Baltimore. And, well, let's just listen to how your narrator tells the rest of the story.
Eventually, Skinner and Beans wake up, and they're just like, is the flag still there? And Key's watching, and the dawn's light breaks, and all of a sudden, Key sees this giant, humongous American flag. And Key is like, yeah, it's still there. It's way there.
That's what he said. That's actual dialogue from Francis Scott Key. Yeah, but what is interesting, I found researching this story, is that how anti-war Francis Scott Key was, that he was only wanting to save his friend Dr. Beans.
Oh, the man that he went out to recover from British custody.
Yes.
Well, now, you mentioned researching the story, and that raises another question that was on my mind. How do you prepare your subjects other than pouring them a drink?
They read up on it, but I never wanted it to be rehearsed or feel like homework. I wanted to feel like they're finally getting to tell this story they've always wanted to tell.
So the method is read up on this while sober and then recount whatever is in your head while drunk.
Learn this, then drink to forget. But try to remember when you were sober and you were excited to hear the story.
So I want to mention for people who have not seen the program that you have actors put on costumes of whatever period and reenact the story that the drunk person is telling. And there's a detail in this Francis Scott Key thing I want to ask you about, because the intoxicated person says Francis Scott Key writes this poem, he's very excited, and so he calls up somebody about it. That's the phrase that is used.
That he calls his brother-in-law, yep.
And so you have the guy in 1814 costume pick up his iPhone and, of course, make a call. Just literally reenact whatever the person says.
Right, exactly. They are the Geppetto to the Pinocchio. You know what I mean?
This leads to a couple of questions.
Yeah.
One of which is simply, how accurate ultimately are the renditions you come up with?
I would say 92%. Every date is accurate. I'll make sure to go back and say, make sure you say this date or this person's name. I don't want to mess up anyone's names, but obviously the dialogue is the stuff that is not accurate.
Francis Scott Key goes to President James Madison, who was the president at the time. He says, listen, the Honorable Dr. Beans has been kidnapped. President James Madison is like, it's like a terrible, like, yeah, obviously, you got to do something about this.
Now, when you have done one of these drunk history episodes, has it ever caused you to get so interested in the topic that you go out and find a book about it?
Yes. Claudette Colvin, who's in our premiere episode, who did what Rosa Parks did months before Rosa Parks, but we've never heard about her. She was a 15-year-old girl who refused to move to the back of the bus and was arrested, and the NAACP got her out of jail. But she was pregnant out of wedlock, and she was darker skin, and they did not think that she would be a good role model. So it's not a like, oh, forget about Rosa Parks. It's a more, let's, you know, God bless Rosa Parks, but let's embrace where this idea came from. And not to be preachy, but to remind people, everyone has a voice, even if you're 15 years old. Mm. And voice doesn't mean tweeting. Mm. Voice means making a change.
Well, that's a great story. Now, conversely, have there been episodes of Drunk History that, as you've learned about the history, you've actually just wanted to get drunk?
Well, I drink with them, and that is letting them know we're doing this together. It makes the subject feel more comfortable. And who would want to do this show if you just had a camera in their face? You said, yeah, drink, drink, talk about history, drink, drink, talk about history. So it's like, hey, I'm going to have a drink with you. And secretly, once they get to a certain stage, I do the old iced tea switch.
Derek Waters is the creator of Drunk History, which is on Comedy Central? Let's take that again.
You can say Comedy Central. That's like the drunk version of how you would say it.
All right. Derek Waters is the creator of Drunk History on Comedy Central. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Cheers.
So they distributed the song to everybody, and people in the town would be kind of like, oh, say, can you see? I get this. I dig it. This will work.
Jimmy Fallon has a not-so-secret weapon on The Tonight Show, the band, The Roots. Drummer and band leader Amir Questlove Thompson says music is a crucial part of the program. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans paid a visit to the show to see how that plays out.
For the first time, a hip-hop group is the house band for the most influential TV show in late night.
Studio 6B in Rockefeller Center in the heart of New York City. It's The Tonight Show starring Jimmy Fallon. Hey, hey, hey,
hey. And you can chalk up much of the Roots' success to the relaxed perfectionism of the band's leader, Questlove. When I first meet him, he's in a mixing room with the sound engineer at The Tonight Show's Rockefeller Center studios. This is like watching Rembrandt splash paint on a canvas.
I'm listening to the mix because we're the musical guest tonight.
He's listening to a recording of the band rehearsing its new single, Never.
If you do this now, then it's not a big deal tonight after we perform it.
The show's engineer is learning the band's sound before they play on camera that evening, and Questlove catches everything, including the thin tone of a woodblock.
Yeah. I don't mean louder, but is there like a thicker texture?
This detail-oriented artistry has paid off well for Questlove and The Roots.
Yeah, that sort of...
The Roots are the last band you might expect to take over a late-night TV institution. They came together in the late 1980s and quickly emerged as critics' favorites. But some hip-hop fans saw them as quirky outsiders for their musicianship and brainy creativity. 5 years ago, when Fallon started hosting NBC's Late Night, he specifically picked The Roots for his house band. But the network suits weren't so sure.
Feelings at NBC were sort of like, okay, we know that they're a good rap group, but what if we have Tom T. Hall on the show? Do they have range?
Can they play country or classical? NBC's solution? A 13-week probation, so they could quietly fire them if it didn't work out.
And they were like throwing crazy stuff at us. They'd come and be like, you guys got 3 minutes to come up with an Andrew Lloyd Webber reference for it. Da 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 da. 3 minutes. And that's how the game Freestyling with the Roots was invented.
Freestyling with the Roots is their version of Johnny Carson's old Stump the Band contest.
And once we did it, then they threw that. They were like, oh, no, you guys are ours forever. Like, you know, forget the 13-week meeting thing.
That test also revealed the Roots' unexpected talent for creating viral videos. They reinvented a sexy, controversial hit with kiddie instruments. And slow jammed the news, even with the leader of the free world.
Jimmy, POTUS stands for President of the United States.
He's the POTUS with the most of.
And when Jimmy Fallon moved up from late night to take over The Tonight Show in February, music stayed at the center of the action.
Because, for starters, Jimmy is a musician. He's a legitimate singer and guitarist. This show is really a variety show disguised as a talk show.
As we're hanging out in the band's tiny rehearsal studio, one of the show's writers stops by to ask for some on-the-spot creativity. In a couple of days, Will Ferrell will be a guest of the show, and so will his lookalike, Chad Smith, drummer for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. They want to have a drum battle, but Ferrell doesn't really play drums.
Yeah, Chad's going to be drumming himself for sure. Will is going to be miming drums to you.
Okay.
So, what I was going to ask is if we could make, like...
a dummy track from the practice tune?
Exactly.
Questlove is going to work up a simple drum solo Will Ferrell can pretend to play on camera. First, he looks up a few drum solos on YouTube for inspiration.
I want something that looks convincing.
Then he sits behind a small drum kit and tries out ideas. On the show, Questlove makes Will Ferrell sound like Buddy Rich.
I just blew my mind.
It's strange to admit it, but this is kind of the job that we were born for.
People who have admired the band's cool, creative artistry didn't always agree.
Once Gawker said, the Roots in this position is like watching Miles Davis busk for change in the New York subway system. We wanted to be underestimated so that you could overexceed expectations.
The success of Questlove and the Roots on The Tonight Show is a tale of triumph. The quirkiest band in hip-hop kept its cool and conquered the biggest institution in late-night TV. I'm Eric Deggans.
along with the wind and along for the ride. Wish I could rest and open my eyes, but time ain't finna fly down from the sky. A place with a lonely love, not another soul's there, only us. Only us.
Street dreams.